Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this latest episode of Oncology Data Advisor. Today, I have the honor of being joined by two of our new editorial board members, Hiam Abdel-Salam and Catherine Skeffis, who are both genetic counselors at MD Anderson Cancer Center. We're so excited to, first of all, both have you on the board and also to have this conversation today. We're going to give us a little bit of an overview of what you do as genetic counselors and tell us a little bit about yourselves. So with that, I will turn it both over to you and you can introduce yourselves and take it away.
All right. Thank you so much. We're excited to be here. And like you said, we're just going to provide an overview of hereditary cancer, genetic counseling, cancer risk evaluation today. But I wanted to start by just talking a little bit about how we sort of got to the field of genetic counseling. And so Hiam, would you mind starting us off with telling us about how you became a genetic counselor?
Yeah, so kind of the truncated version. I really enjoyed my high school genetics class, especially the parts where we learned about how genetic diseases is really a family. It's a family thing. It impacts different family members instead of just your patient. So when I started college, I was kind of, you know, the typical pre-med, you know, knew I wanted to interact with patients in some way, but kind of got to a point where I knew I wasn't particularly interested in being a physician, but was still really interested in clinical genetics. So kind of did some research, and I was lucky enough to get connected with genetic counselors at my institution where I was going to university, and was able to intern with them. So that really gave me the chance to actually learn a lot more about hereditary cancer conditions, what cancer genetic counseling is, and that kind of set up the path for me to end up in genetic counseling school. What about you, Catherine? I'm actually really curious about how you started.
Yeah, my story is very different. And I mean, we've worked together for years now, and I never heard that story. So I'm glad we're talking about this.
Me too.
I actually, I had not heard too much about genetic counseling in high school or anything like that. I did enjoy my genetics class in college, but actually found it really difficult and actually even had a professor tell me that maybe genetics wasn't for me, which is sort of funny in hindsight. But I ended up studying medical anthropology after college. I got a degree in that. And then I worked in nonprofit for a while and worked with cancer patients in more of a fundraising type of avenue. But I didn't find myself quite fulfilled enough because I wanted to get back to the science aspect of things too, and realized how much I loved working with cancer patients and that I wanted to do it in more of a clinical setting. And so I was able to go back to school for genetic counseling, and that's how I ended up here. And turns out that professor was not right. Genetics is my thing.
I think that's my favorite part of our field is that everybody has such different journeys and how they end up in genetic counseling. And, you know, every path is just as valuable as the other one.
Absolutely. So let's talk about ending up in genetic counseling on the other side of the table or the other side of the room, and talk about what who is recommended to be seen by a genetic counselor in the cancer realm.
Yeah. So I usually tell people that really anybody that has an interest in learning about hereditary contributors of their cancer, whether it's their own or if they don't have cancer themselves but have family members, I always say that genetic counseling is a good fit for them to have the conversation. I think there can sometimes be a misconception that you have to know that you are interested in genetic testing to want to see a genetic counselor, and that's certainly not the case. It really is about providing information and learning more about your interest in testing or not. So kind of, I would say within that general population of people who have a personal family history, there certainly are individuals that we're a little bit more suspicious of, have more red flags than others. Kind of the ones that I always think about in the back of my mind as I'm talking about patients are those early cancer diagnoses, especially with the more common cancers like breast, colon, or uterine cancers. And then, you know, as I'm sure you know, Catherine, because you're a lot more in the rare malignancies and rare benign tumor space, There can certainly be specific types of tumors or cancers, regardless of age, where we tend to be more suspicious of. So those might be certain types of brain cancers or pheochromocytomas, paragangliomas. Those kinds of patients we always like to encourage to be seen by a genetic counselor to talk about options for genetic testing. So overall, if I like to tell, you know, if providers are talking to me, if your patient ever mentions genetic testing questions about their family, go ahead and send them to us, whether or not they meet guidelines. But definitely the early onset cancers, the rare kinds of cancers, or even if they're seeing similar cancers in a family that's clustering on the same side, or certain patterns that might make us suspicious for a specific condition, then that those are really great patients to come in and see us. So kind of going along with that, Catherine, you know, I'm sure you know that genetic testing is getting more and more accessible throughout the years. What do you think makes seeing a genetic counselor specifically unique and helpful for a patient instead of maybe just, you know, getting testing ordered by their doctor, or, you know, going online and going ahead and ordering testing for themselves? What do you think that interaction is really valuable for?
Yes, we might be a little bit biased, but we definitely see value in that interaction. It's, you know, part of the definition of genetic counseling is the process of helping people understand and adapt to genetic risk of disease. And so I think that's a really big part of what we do. Many of us in our training programs are trained both, well, all of us really are trained both in the counseling side of things and the science side of things. And it really makes us uniquely able to connect with patients and help them understand sort of abstract concepts like risk and how that risk might impact them, how that risk might impact them not only physically in their chances of developing a cancer or tumor, but also emotionally in the possible anxiety that can come from knowing this type of things, in navigating discussions with family members, in, you know, delivering difficult news to family members or their children or whoever it might be that might also have that increased risk. So I think that that genetic counselors can really bridge that gap between the psychological and the physical in terms of helping people understand what their risks might be. And then the other part of things is we can often take more time than some other providers with a patient. We're fortunate in many cases to have 45 minutes or an hour to spend with a patient if they need it to discuss not only their family history and the logistical things about genetic testing, but also what I was mentioning before about those psychosocial impacts and things like that. So I always think that, you know, just like Hiam said, if someone is even interested in thinking about their hereditary risk, a genetic counselor is a great first stop to help them understand their options and what it might mean for them.
Definitely.
So Hiam, we've talked a little bit about the process of genetic counseling, but how can people actually use the test results of genetic testing for their benefit or their family's benefit?
Yeah. So there are so many different ways. And I think each way is different depending on that particular patient and that particular family. Definitely the most common ones is, you know, providing information on either the primary contributor to a cancer diagnosis or cancers in a family, or, you know, one of the many contributors to, you know, a cancer in a family. So really thinking about information on what's causing these cancers in a family, that a lot of times can provide patients with kind of some solace and peace and understanding, okay, this is why I developed this cancer, or this is why there's so many of these similar cancers in my family that maybe they didn't have before doing this test. Beyond that, in many cases, genetic testing can be helpful in making decisions for treatment. So I, you know, among the many different centers I work with, the two that are in there are the breast and the prostate centers. So I see a lot of patients, particularly in the prostate clinic, that are coming in with metastatic disease and wanting to know if they qualify for medications like olaparib, where that qualification can be defined by genetic testing results if they have a BRCA1 or a BRCA2 mutation. So that's definitely one way that genetic testing can have a significant impact on survival and having an impact on and really making sure that we're taking care of our patients and giving them the best treatment that is available for them. kind of thinking outside of treatment, then we think about other cancers, second other primary cancers that patients may be at risk for, or just knowing if you're at risk for a primary cancer in general. That can really help patients make decisions about management. That can go as far as surveillance recommendations, either earlier or more frequent surveillance. Sometimes we might be thinking about prophylactic surgeries, so prophylactic mastectomies, prophylactic oophorectomies to significantly reduce the risk of developing a primary cancer. And then, as we've been talking about so far in this conversation, also thinking about, our patient in a family unit. So how does this information impact cancer risks for other people in your family, your children, siblings, parents, even extended relatives? This is information that might be helpful for them to know if they're at a significantly elevated risk for certain types of cancers, and really kind of giving them a head start to making sure they're following the appropriate cancer screening. So this is usually something that, I think is really great for patients to get a general picture of ahead of time when helping them to make a decision on whether this test is a good fit for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I always like to walk patients through those different potential outcomes of testing. And sometimes one more than the other sort of resonates with a patient about what might prompt them to do the testing.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of times I'll hear that, patients are coming in, maybe not so much for themselves, but wanting to know for their family members if this is something that's going to be helpful. So kind of going over that with them is really something that kind of tips the scale on whether this is something that's informative for them.
Absolutely.
So Catherine, we kind of talked a little bit about what is entailed in genetic counseling, some of the topics that we might think about, and who are some of those people that we'd want to come into the session. Can you tell me a little bit about, when you're either in that in-person interaction, in that video call, or in that telephone call, some of those topics that you really like to make sure that you're covering with the patient?
Yes. So I always like to start my appointments with patients by asking them in some way what their understanding is of the purpose of the appointment. I think especially if a patient has an active cancer diagnosis, they are just having appointments added to their schedule left and right. And so I always want to make sure going into the appointment that they know what my job is, what we're going to talk about during the appointment, and what they hope to get out of the appointment if they do have any specific questions and things like that coming in. But from there, we always go through a detailed medical history and family history. We take really detailed family histories, not only about the people who have had cancer, but those who haven't had cancer as well. We really want to get the full picture so that we can make an accurate risk assessment. And then from there, I always do my genes and chromosomes blurb. I don't care if this person across from me is a geneticist or a physician. They might know more about certain topics in genetics than I do, but I always want to make sure that everybody's on the same page and understanding what we're talking about. So I talk about how we all are born with over 20,000 genes, and an important set of those genes is meant to protect us from developing cancer. And that's really what we're looking at. We're looking at the genetic information that a person was born with to see if they were born with a difference in one of those genes that caused them to have a higher risk of developing cancer. Sometimes my genes and chromosomes spiel is as simple as that. And sometimes I go into a little bit more detail, just depending on the exact indication that we're talking about. And then from there, we talk about genetic testing options, in terms of whether we want to do a very specific genetic test or whether we want to do a broader test. And when I say we, I really mean the patient. It's up to them, how broad they want to go with genetic testing. Although there's typically sort of a minimum recommended or, what type of guidelines the patient met that we can sort of guide them with. So we don't just say, okay, what type of testing do you want? We say, here are some options. Here's the, testing that's indicated based on your personal and family history, and perhaps here are some other options as well. We then talk about the logistics of testing. So we can do it through a blood sample or a saliva sample. For children, we can do testing through a cheek swab as well. That can be easier for a parent to get a sample that way from a child. And then if someone has a blood malignancy or has had a stem cell transplant, we would talk about needing to do testing through a skin punch biopsy. Once we have the sample, which in for a vast majority of people is either blood or saliva, we say the results take about 2 or 3 weeks from that time to get those results back, at which time we would let them know what the results say and what that means for them and their family. So the appointment is sort of a quarter information gathering, a quarter information giving, and then some back and forth discussion about what type of testing feels best for the patient and things even like, is now the right time for them to do testing? If they've just been diagnosed, maybe it's not the right time. And so we are able to talk with the patient at length about, what feels best for them in terms of testing.
Love how we kind of talked about it as a conversation instead of, okay, this is the test that we are recommending that you take, which is rarely how we frame it.
Exactly. I can think of really just a handful of indications where we can say, okay, this is the cancer that we're dealing with, and here's the one gene that we would test for. That used to sort of be the how it always went, but now we know so much more about genetics, and I like for our patients to understand that to some extent and to see what type of testing feels best for them. So when we get those results back in 2, 3 weeks or so, Hiam, can you talk a little bit about the different types of results and what that might mean for a patient?
Yeah, definitely. So, there can definitely be some rare instances, but in the general sense, we kind of talked about, finding a hereditary cancer condition. So that's going to be our positive results. Basically, how I explain that to a patient is, of those 20,000 genes that we have, there's a subset that's really supposed to be protecting us from developing specific kinds of cancers, but we might be born with one of those genes just not working properly, or one copy of those genes not working properly. And that's because there's a variant or a mutation that's pathogenic. It's impacting the ability for this gene to work well. So kind of in that conversation, if we find that there's a result like that, we'll talk about what specifically is that gene, what do we know from the literature, from, our understanding of these genes, the cancer risks that are associated with it. And then really the part that the patient is invested in is, the recommendations for screening. How does this change things for them and for other people in their family? So that's kind of the menu of things that we'll talk about with positive findings. With negative results, which is, the most common result that we're going to get back. In the majority of cases, they're sequencing through these genes and everyone is born with, or those patients are born with them working perfectly fine. That's, the most common conversation that I'll have with a patient. So what I like to really emphasize with negative results, especially if we're talking about, a patient who does not know anything about a hereditary cause for cancer in their family, they're coming in, they did genetic counseling, they did a panel. Negative results are really reassuring. So it definitely, rules out many of the known hereditary causes for those cancers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that this cancer or this family history is not hereditary. There's always that residual risk that remains. So I just like to make sure to go over that. And talking to patients about that remaining risk being, limitations in genetic testing itself and the technology, not being able to identify all possible mutations that someone can have. And then also just our limited knowledge in candidate genes. So those genes that may be related to specific cancers in a family, but we can't test for them because the research is just not there yet in identifying the link of that gene with those specific cancers and knowing if we need to be making any changes in a patient's care based off of that specific gene. We can definitely talk about this later on, but that's kind of where thinking about options for updated testing definitely can come in for patients as we're learning more and more about these genes. Something else that, a lot of times patients don't come in anticipating, or perhaps non-genetics providers are not too familiar with, are what we call those variants of uncertain significance. So this is really detecting a difference in a gene, but either there is limited clinical data or limited functional data on these specific variants, or there may be conflicting data around these variants where the lab just really is not able to truly say if this is pathogenic, it's impacting the function of this gene and creating a cancer risk for patients and their families, or if this is something that's likely benign, it's, you know, just a normal variant that someone has in their gene, not creating any cancer risks or any other health issues. So when we see these variants of uncertain significance, we typically act in the more conservative side, where we're not recommending any changes in screening or management, no changes in treatment, typically not recommending testing for people in the family for this specific variant. And that's because in about 90% of cases with these variants of uncertain significance, they end up being reclassified as likely benign or benign. And that's just because of the nature of genetics. We have several variants throughout our genetic code. It's very common for us to have differences, and the majority of them are benign. Only a very small subset are pathogenic, creating some specific disease or health issue for a person or their family. So those are usually the different kinds of results that I at least will like to go over. Now, there can be those quirky, funny ones like our mosaic findings that I'm sure, Catherine, you've come across once in a while. And those are things where, you know, we might want to take in a little bit more preparation and go into a little bit more detail with the patient when those results come through on what that actually means for them and their family members. So, Catherine, it's pretty common, at least for me, to have a patient where they don't really have a lot of understanding or even expectations for the session. You know, they've either never heard of genetic counseling before, or it may be an appointment or a consult that their provider referred them for, but did not really get a lot of context on what this appointment is going to be about or what they need to be bringing into a session. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's anything that patients could do to maybe be more prepared for coming into a genetic counseling session? Any information that would be great for them to bring in ahead of time?
Yes, I think the main thing that people can do to prepare for a genetic counseling appointment is just to ask their family members about medical history. That's the main thing. You don't need to like study up on your genetics or review your notes from college. Just ask family about their cancer history, cancer type, age at diagnosis, perhaps even what type of treatments they had. Those can all be useful things that your genetic counselor might ask you about. And then two, if any family members have had genetic testing, and get a copy of the results if possible. This is especially important if someone is seeing a genetic counselor or having genetic testing done because there is a known mutation in the family. It's very important that the genetic counselor or whoever is ordering the testing can set their eyes on that report to be able to not only counsel accurately to make sure that what we're counseling on is what was found in your family, but also just to be able to order the correct test. We would never want to order the wrong test because we weren't sure of what that genetic mutation was in the family. So those are the main things that someone can do to prepare. And then, Hiam, you had mentioned before about sometimes people might want to consider updated testing. So in what circumstances do you think someone who has had genetic testing in the past might want to consider thinking about updated genetic testing?
Yeah, the most common instances are when patients have had prior genetic testing, but it was 10, 15 years prior, where our knowledge on the genes that are related to specific cancer types in a family, as far as hereditary conditions, was much more limited. So, you know, a really common case that I'll see is a patient has had BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene analysis only. That was the extent of their tests because that's all we knew about at the time. But now we know that there are several other genes that can predispose people to breast or ovarian cancer. So that's a really good example where we would encourage someone to come back in for genetic counseling to talk about going through genetic testing again. I usually just tell people it's great to follow up with genetics every couple of years or so just to see if there's any new genes. We learn about new genes pretty frequently, depending on the cancer type and and the family history. So if I just usually tell people if they're ever wondering about updated testing and they've already had negative results, it's always fair game for you to come back in and have that conversation again. But I would say, definitely if you're someone that's already had testing and it was many, many years ago, that's a great opportunity to come back in and have that conversation with us because it really can be something that impacts screening, explanations of your cancer in your family, and also potentially treatment, depending on where you're at with your cancer journey.
I would also add to that if there have been any major changes in the family history, because perhaps when you first had testing done, it was because there was breast cancer on your mom's side, but now a relative on your father's side has been diagnosed with colon cancer or something like that, that might prompt additional or different testing from what was originally ordered.
I think that's definitely a great example of, family histories can change very frequently, or you may be coming in with limited information about your family, and now a couple of years later, you've learned new things, and that can always be very valuable information to be evaluated for. So it's always great to either, share that with your provider that you're seeing annually, or just kind of sending a quick message, giving a quick call to your dinner counselor to go over that information together. So, Catherine, we kind of talked a lot about the many great things that you can learn from a genetic counseling session, but also genetic testing. What are some things that you think are helpful for patients to keep in mind where it may not be so beneficial for them to do a genetic testing at this time?
Sure. So there are a few different reasons why people might not want to have genetic testing. Sometimes I'll be talking with a patient and I'll say, is this testing that you think you're interested in or that you want to do? And they'll say, yeah, absolutely. Why not? Why wouldn't everybody just go out and do this? And there really are a couple of good reasons that people might want to consider as they're thinking about this. So, one is that if someone is dealing with a new diagnosis and this genetic testing may not have a direct impact on the next step in their treatment, they may just decide that this is not something that they sort of have the capacity for right now. They may say, let me figure out what's next? Let me figure out my surgery date. Let me figure out, let me get to feeling better after my surgery, and then I'll consider opening up this aspect of my care and thinking about communicating with family and stuff like that. So, one reason might just be timing. I regularly talk with people who I say, okay, I'll, put you back on my calendar for 3 months from now, and we can talk about this then when you might have a little bit more bandwidth to think about this side of things. The other thing that people might consider is genetic discrimination, which oftentimes people don't even realize that that's a thing until we bring it up as part of our, as part of the consent process for testing. There is a federal law called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. This protects people from discrimination when it comes to health insurance and most employment. So your health insurance company is not allowed to increase your rates or drop you from coverage based on a positive genetic test result. So that's a good thing. That's a reassuring thing that we have that type of protection. But that law does not extend to things like life insurance, long-term care insurance, and disability insurance. So for those types of insurance policies, if you go to apply for a private policy with one for one of those types of insurances, they are allowed to ask for genetic testing results, just like they're allowed to ask for medical records or family history. And so oftentimes when especially when I'm meeting with a patient for predictive testing, where maybe there is a known mutation in the family, or there's a family history of cancer, but the patient themselves has not been affected at this time, that potential for genetic discrimination can come into play for some patients, and they may opt to delay testing or not to have testing done if they do have concerns about insurance. But we always recommend that people discuss that with an insurance lawyer or something like that if they do have major concerns from that perspective. Because even though we know about the law and we can educate to some extent, we are not lawyers, and so we can't give out that type of advice, but we can at least let people know that it can be on their radar when they're thinking about it. And then sometimes people decline testing just because they don't want to know, and that's okay. Sometimes people just say, I'm going to keep on doing the cancer screenings that my doctor recommends, but beyond that, I don't want to think about future cancer risk at this time. They may know themselves to know that it would make them too anxious, or that it would be something that would constantly be on their mind, preventing them from living their best lives because they'd be worried about that. And so that's also something that comes up sometimes that may make people not want to get genetic testing done. Now, I know another possible reason people might have for not getting genetic testing can be cost. So, Hiam, how do you counsel patients about the potential for out-of-pocket costs for genetic testing? I feel like sometimes people have in their mind that this is going to cost them like thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, definitely my favorite topic in when speaking with patients. I usually will let patients know that in most cases genetic testing is covered by insurance. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not an out-of-pocket cost, but usually a majority of the cost is covered, especially if you are a patient who meets NCCN or National Cancer Center Network guidelines for genetic testing. Which exists for many different cancer types, including things like breast, ovarian, colon, pancreatic, uterine cancers. So most private labs that genetic counselors will order testing through will estimate around $100 or less in the majority of cases, where they have an in-network insurance with that patient's provider. Now, there's definitely things that we can do if you're kind of outside of NCCN guidelines, or even if you are within guidelines but just want that reassurance to try to provide patients with more information. That could be things like trying to submit a prior authorization with your insurance company, or we can provide patients with billing codes and they can inquire with their insurance company on, if this is something that's going to be covered for them before they ever start the process of actually getting the testing done. Many private labs have what's called self-pay prices for testing, where instead of going through insurance, you can have a direct bill. That's usually about $250 if you're just wanting to pay independently. And then there's also patient assistance programs that exist with some of these labs, where if you provide some information on your financial situation, that can sometimes be enough to help reduce the price of your testing if for some reason it gets still declined from your insurance. So definitely compared to the beginning of genetic testing where it was in the thousands of dollars, definitely the landscape has changed, especially now that insurance companies have specific criteria for how they're going to cover genetic testing that's helped to reduce the price. And also with the changes in how testing is done, that's also significantly helped to reduce the price in testing overall. But I would agree, definitely an important conversation that I have with almost all of my patients, just to make sure that they are, as much as I can control, not hit with an unexpected bill. So kind of just to get us closer to wrapping up, Catherine, definitely we know that we rely on providers to make sure that they're sending patients to us for genetic counseling, but sometimes providers don't know that much about what genetic counseling is, or how to refer their patients, or there are many patients out there that have never heard of genetic counseling. Do you feel like beyond this, is there any resources that's kind of your go-to to share with a provider or a patient just to learn a little bit more about genetic counseling on their own?
Definitely. So our national organization is called NSGC, National Society of Genetic Counselors, and there are a ton of resources on that website just about what to expect in an appointment, how to who should see a genetic counselor. Even we've only been talking about cancer genetic counseling today, but there is also genetic counseling available for pregnant patients or patients who have pediatric conditions and things like that. So that NSGC website is a great source of information about genetics and genetic counseling in general. They also have a great tool that is very aptly named findageneticcounselor.nsgc.org. And so that is a great place where you can go to type in essentially what you're looking for, the location, the specialty, whether they offer telemedicine visits, and you can find genetic counselors in your area that might be able to help you. And then I also wanted to note that many genetic testing labs also have genetic counselors on staff. So if someone has gotten a genetic testing report from their provider and they have additional questions, you can usually call the genetic testing lab directly and speak with a genetics provider in that way as well. So as we're wrapping up this discussion, Hiam, I just wanted to ask you, what is your favorite thing about being a genetic counselor and the job that you do?
So many things. No. I of the many, I think my favorite is that I'm able to help patients understand things in pretty simple terms and give patients information to the level that they need to understand. I think especially for our patients who are going through an active cancer, going through active treatment. The field of cancer itself is filled with a lot of technical terms, a lot of scientific terms, a lot of different treatments, just a lot of information. And sometimes that can be overwhelming, where patients can oftentimes feel like they don't really have a strong grasp of what's going on. But one of my favorite things about my training is that we're really taught to communicate to patients at their level and at their communication style, and providing them with just the right of information that they need without overwhelming them. So it really means a lot to me when I hear from patients that I explain something well, even though I'm sure they're saying that to a lot of their providers, but just telling me that I understand what you're saying, I think goes a long way in making sure that a patient feels empowered and feels that they have the autonomy to really take on their journey head on.
Absolutely. That's such a special part of our job. I think for me, one of my favorite moments or experiences as a genetic counselor, in addition to what you said about a patient just saying, I get it, you know, that makes sense, is when I see a patient's family member for predictive testing. That's really a full circle moment for us as genetic counselors because it shows that the patient that we initially met with understood the implications of their results, communicated that with family, which we all talk with our patients about, and that the family member followed up with that and chose to come see us again. It's just I think that that's a really, really special part of our job that where we can see the impact that we're having not only on our patient but on our family members as well.
Yeah, I love that too. I love when I get a phone call of I'm so and so's daughter. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, like your mom actually like talked to you about this and you're wanting to like do something about it. It feels really like that.
It's really cool.
Well, I love talking with you, Catherine. I'm glad we got to give like a good introduction on what we do, and I'm excited to kind of dig deeper into some of the different spaces, topics that we get to touch.
I'm looking forward to this too. This was fun having this conversation with you, and I'm looking forward to our next one.
Amazing. Thank you both so much. This was such a wonderfully informative conversation about how you entered the field of genetic counseling, what you do on a day-to-day basis, how you help patients navigate all of these aspects. So thank you so much for coming on to explain all of this. And like you said, I'm looking forward to working with both of you on the editorial board and digging a little bit deeper into the diseases that you see. So thank you both again. This is such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.